Hi, I want to welcome everybody to our conference call this afternoon. Thanks for joining us. My name is John Neurohr, and before we begin, I want to give you my contact info. I'm a press assistant here at the Center for American Progress. If anybody has any other questions or they want to contact one of the authors of the report afterwards, after the call, they can contact me. You can give me a call at 202-481-8182, and my email address is jneurohr@americanprogress.org. We actually did release this report today, How to Redeploy. It's available at our website, americanprogress.org. On the call today, we have Larry Korb, who's a senior fellow here at the Center for American Progress. We also have Max Bergman, who is a research associate. Both Larry and Max, in just a second, are going to talk briefly about the report. Then we're going to open it up to any questions. We also have Brian Katulis, also a senior fellow here at the Center for American Progress, available for that Q&A that we'll do after Larry and Max explain the report a little bit. So I'm going to turn it right now over to Larry Korb.
Thank you all for coming. This report is the eighth in a series that we've put out about how to deal with the situation in Iraq. My colleagues here, including Brian and Max and Peter Jewell and Sean Duggan, have put out two versions of our strategic redeployment. We put out a strategic reset. We have done a study on both the use of the active duty brigades and the guard brigades, and we've done studies on the Army and Marine Corps equipment. Now, in those previous studies, we have shown why it's necessary for the United States to set a timetable so that we will not be hostage to events there, and we can begin a diplomatic surge as well as put pressure on the Iraqi government to do what they need to do. And we really feel that this is the best way to promote our security interests in the region and around the world. Now, as we pointed out in our previous studies, and we mentioned it in this study on how to redeploy, we will not leave the region. We will leave troops in the region, as we've been arguing for quite a while. You'll have at least a brigade and an air wing in Kuwait, a carrier battle group, and a Marine Expeditionary Force offshore. As well as when we leave, we recommend putting two brigades into the Kurdish area for about 1 year to ensure that the problems between Turkey and the Kurds do not escalate. And then obviously you would leave the Marines at the embassy, as we have Marines at all of our embassies around the world. However, in this report and others, we talk about the fact that you've really got to downsize that embassy. Now, turning to this report, how to redeploy, what we're trying to come up with is a plan to how to redeploy from Iraq in a responsible, cost-effective, safe manner. Now, there some disagreement among people about how rapid and how long drawn out it should be. Some people want to get out very, very quickly. Others want to a very long, drawn out redeployment. We really think, as we point out in this report, that this is a false dilemma. You can do both. You can get out very quickly if you had to, and you can draw it out if, in fact, that's what you want to do. But our feeling is that over the 10 to 12 months from when you set the date, you can do it in an orderly and safe manner that allows you to get your troops out with a minimum of risk to them, as well as get out all of the essential equipment that you need. Now, we don't underestimate the task. This is a daunting task, but it's well within the capabilities of the U.S. military. Our military excels in logistics, which I know from my own experience in the service, as well as supervising logistics when I was in government. Now, what have you got? You've got somewhere around 160,000 troops, 75 forward operating bases, and some 200 metric tons of equipment. So it is a challenging and daunting task. But remember, we've done this already. In the starting in December of 2003 through the spring of 2004, roughly a period of about 4 months, we moved in and out of Iraq some 235,000 people and equipment. And at that time, we moved over 200 metric tons of equipment. Not only was it done well, but the casualties were actually lower than they were after we had all of those troops in place. Now, those want to get out, and if you had to get out in 3 months, basically what we're talking about is an invasion in reverse. This is possible, but we do not feel it's the best way to do it. You would obviously, if you did it that quickly, you would have to leave a significant amount of equipment, and you would also create an instantaneous political and security vacuum, which would be as bad as the one you created by not planning for the aftermath of the fall of Saddam Hussein. Now, those who argue that it should take up to 4 years basically would be taking equipment of no military value. You don't have to dismantle your gyms and your PXs and take out every piece, for example, of X-ray equipment. And this would not only wouldn't be cost effective. You're spending, as we now know, about $12 billion a month, but your troops would be more in danger by taking so long to get out, and it would prevent you from sending your troops to where they're needed. For example, we can use more troops in Afghanistan. Now, a lot of people who talk about taking a much longer time than we propose say, well, it's hard to get all the stuff, at the seaports in Kuwait. Well, the fact of the matter is, once you get to Kuwait, then it's a different problem. Then you can take your time. And remember this, that all equipment is not equal. An armored Humvee or a tank has got much more value than a dismantling a gymnasium. Now, we also urge that really you should be planning to do it now because the United States needs to get ahead of the game. And if the administration doesn't want to do it, we think Congress should demand a plan to get out. Now, let me turn to how we would do it, the specifics. And we've got a couple of charts that have been put together here by my colleagues within the report. Basically, and what we would do is shrink from the outside in, eventually consolidate around Baghdad, and then go out to Kuwait along route Tampa. And remember, we're already using Tampa to send supplies in for the troops there, so it's not like this road is not being used. Basically, we would take out the equivalent of 2 brigades and supporting troops a month. We'd have to extend the tours of about 3 brigades for about a month to ensure that we do it in a safe way. And we would not replace the units as their tours expired, except for one Marine. We send in one Marine, a Marine Expeditionary Force for another 7-month tour. We would close the forward operating bases. Remember, again, we've already closed them. There were more than 100, and General Casey closed them. And actually, General Casey, now the Army Chief of Staff, had a proposal to get them down to only 4 operating bases. Again, if you wanted to do it in the time we suggest, you can't take everything, nor should you get yourself involved in accounting for every single piece of equipment. On the way out, we would have a brigade from the 82nd and the 2nd Cavalry Regiment with strikers provide security on the road down. We put the heavy equipment on transporters. We'd also make use of airlift. You don't have to have all the troops go out through Kuwait, only the ones that you need to protect the forces on their way out. You could fly a lot of the troops and their headquarters staffs and a lot of the supporting forces out. Again, we have a chart in there that shows you how much airlift that we have that we've been able to do this. We also make the point here, and again, we made it in our other reports, that you've got to get the Iraqis out as well, the Iraqis who've helped us, and the best estimate we have is about 120,000 of them. You have to make provision to make sure that they get out safely because their lives are in danger now from helping us, and when we leave would be in even more danger. Now, with that, we really feel that you could get out the some 1,900 heavy tanks and armored personnel carriers, the 43,000 vehicles that you have, including the 20,000 Humvees and the 700 aircraft. Eventually, you'd have to increase your capability in Kuwait by getting another port to be able to get the equipment back to the United States. But again, let me emphasize, once you're in Kuwait, you've got you basically have got your troops out of danger. All right, let me summarize this by saying this type of redeployment plays to our strengths. We're very good at logistics. I quote in here a plaque I used to have in my office and when I was in government from attributed to Admiral Ernest King, who was the commander-in-chief of the fleet and the chief of naval operations in World War II, who basically said, you know, professionals focus on logistics, amateurs focus on strategies. It would not leave a vacuum, and it would enhance our overall security. And again, let me emphasize, in concert with some of the other proposals we made in our other plans, more specifically and most lately in strategic reset. So let me stop there and see if Max has anything you want to add.
Yeah, hi. I think Larry hit on most of the important points. The only thing I'd add is the notion that U.S. forces are going to be shot at when we withdraw. And I think we sort of touch on this directly in the report. And we think actually what we're doing by withdrawing would actually play to the strengths of the U.S. military, that it's a conventional operation that U.S. military forces train for, prepare for, have experience in conducting. And we also, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the single route out of Iraq on through Route Tampa. We currently use this route every day in ferrying supplies from Kuwait into the heart of Iraq. Also, we would have convoy protection there, and we would leave it up to the brigades whether they want to physically drive out, which therefore provides more of a conventional combat protection, or whether if the threat environment is low enough to actually just put the heavy vehicles on heavy transporters so you don't wear them down when you're withdrawing. So I think in the issue with IEDs, there is a threat of IEDs being placed on this route, but every time U.S. soldiers leave their forward operating bases and go out and drive around in Iraq, they're put under the threat of IEDs. And we think that that threat will basically be unchanged. So I think when the notion of the U.S. being shot out or withdrawing under fire, I think with the threat environment in which the U.S. is going to withdraw won't be unchanged.
So I think at this point, we're going to open it up to question and answers.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will conduct the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star and one on your phone now, and you will be placed in the queue in the order received. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press pound. We are now ready to begin. Our first question comes from Gordon Trowbridge from Detroit News. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. This is less a question about the logistics and more a question about the strategy. But given the fact that the main proposal in Congress that has lots of political support tends to be the Levin Reed idea of leaving a residual force in place, I wonder either from a strategic or tactical standpoint or from a logistics standpoint, how what you folks would do differs from that, and to the extent that it does, why do you think that would be the wrong way to go?
Well, I think it's very important that we get out completely because we want to send a signal to the other countries in the region that they have got to take some responsibility for what happens in Iraq. Iran is not going to cooperate with you as long as you have forces in Iraq because they think they'll use that as a launching pad to go against them. And we get the benefits of protecting our interests by having forces in Kuwait and a carrier battle group and a Marine Expeditionary Force in the Gulf that you would get by leaving the troops in Iraq. And then finally, if you go down to a comparatively small number of troops in Iraq, I think you're actually endangering those troops because they would have less protection than they do now, or they would be put in a situation where if they were just to focus on a very narrow mission, as some people have talked about counterterrorism, would they ignore people killing each other in a civil war? Let me ask Brian if he wants to add anything to that.
I think this is Brian Katulis. I think the Levin Reed approach is a sound one, but I think it needs to be updated in our view. In particular, they talk about three core missions that these residual forces would execute. And the one point that we raise in our strategic reset report, which was the precursor to this one, is that the mission of training Iraq's security forces should be brought to an end. that the medicine of more weapons and training for Iraq security forces may actually end up killing the patient in today's Iraq, in the context of no consensus among Iraq's leaders about what it is and should be. If you look at the trend lines inside of Iraq, with the violence just escalating, as we very well may be arming up different sides in Iraq's civil wars. And that's so, you know, to answer your question there, I think that the Senators Levin and Reid, like many people, are looking to update their proposals to reflect the complex reality in Iraq. And we're saying that some of those core missions that the residual forces would execute are no longer relevant for advancing U.S. national security interests.
Our next question comes from Nicholas Johnston from Bloomberg News. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I wonder if you guys could talk about the inevitability of some sort of troop reduction just because the military sort of doesn't have the strength to sustain sort of the surge in the additional number of troops there.
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that you can't maintain 160,000 troops in Iraq as well as keep your commitments in Afghanistan without extending the tours of the people already in Iraq beyond 15 months. And that's why the consensus is that by next spring, you're going to have to start, you know, taking your levels down. And my guess is the way that they would do that is just not replace the units when their 15 months expires. But as Max and I have written, we wrote in the Los Angeles Times over Memorial Day weekend, for people arguing to keep this high level of troops in Iraq beyond next spring, they ought to put their money where their mouth is and talk about conscription, because you can't do it with a volunteer army. We've already overstressed the active force and violated our commitments to the Guard and Reserve about how often we would call them up. Remember, as we pointed out in our last report on Guard, talking about the Guard and Reserve, the four Guard units that are going to become part of this surge later this year and early next year, some of them haven't even had 3 years at home.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Barry Schweid from Associated Press. Go ahead, please.
Yes, a couple of questions. Yesterday, Ahmadinejad spoke of an intensifying political vacuum in Iraq and how Iran would be happy to step in. He didn't say whether it's military, but doesn't the withdrawal of U.S. troops enhance the vacuum that Iran would like to see? And secondly, I think it was Larry, I wish you people would identify yourselves when you speak. It's hard to tell who's saying what. But I think it was Larry Korb who said, you have to make sure the Iraqis that helped us get out safely. That's more than 100,000 Iraqis. Where would you put them?
Well, Barry, let me take your second question first. This is Larry Korb. Basically, we did the strategic reset, that there's no reason why you can't settle that many in this country. As we point out in this report, after the fall of Saigon, we settled in about 6 months 130,000 Vietnamese. And we quote Julia Taft, who was in charge of that, saying, you know, the president said do it, we got it done. So it can easily be done. We can have them here. We obviously can work with other countries if we need to. But our point is, you do have a moral responsibility to those people who put their lives on the line to help us in this occupation of Iraq. I'll let Brian go ahead and talk about Iran.
Barry, this is Brian Katulis. I think our argument would be that that vacuum has already exists, and it existed since 2003 when we went in there, when President Bush made the decision to go in with an insufficient number of troops, as he was advised by General Shinseki, and we simply don't have those troops. And Iran has a great deal of influence, not only in the southern part of the country, which we're seeing every day with the events in Basra and other places, and many of the different political actors that are leading Iraq's government. They also have quite good ties with the Kurdish leadership, and their influence is there. So I think President Ahmadinejad's statement is a statement of fact. Even with U.S. troops there, there has been a vacuum. There's been a lack of security and order, and this has been exploited by numerous militia groups. And frankly, despite some possible tactical gains militarily in certain neighborhoods, the fundamentals have shifted dramatically. You look at Baghdad, the capital city, used to be a Sunni-majority city, 65% Sunni. It is now a Shiite-majority city, 75%, U.S. officials tell us. All of these dynamics portray a picture where Iran has seen an historic expansion of its influence as a consequence of the way that the Bush administration went into Iraq. And when you look at the practical matter of we need to start drawing down our troop presence, we need to focus more on diplomatic and political initiatives to make sure that they play a constructive role in that country.
Our next question comes from Mark Silva from Chicago Tribune. Go ahead, please.
Given that the administration has made
Mark, if you're—I don't know if it's—if you're on a cell phone or not, but we're having a little trouble hearing you.
Can you hear me at all?
That's a little bit better.
Yeah, that's good now.
Is that okay now?
Yeah, perfect. Thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry. Given that it seems fairly predictable that the administration is counting on General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker to present a case in September for the continuation of the mission.
Sorry, Mark, we can't hear you at all.
Trailing off again, Mark.
Oh, boy. Can we try this one?
There we go.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right. Hey. I apologize. Thanks for your patience.
No problem.
I'll just do it quickly again. You know, it seems pretty predictable that the administration is counting on General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker to lay out a case for a continuation of the mission as it exists for at least the next few months, perhaps into spring. What sort of practical alternative do you see the Democrats being able to, and perhaps a smattering of Republicans being able to convince the military to accept in some sort of contingent, you know, funding bill? Warner has talked about, you know, some number of troops by December. Is there at all any practical drawdown which could occur before spring in the current political environment?
This is Larry Korb. I think the key is not going to, don't forget, yes, General Petraeus will be given a report, but General Petraeus doesn't work for the president's or the Congress directly. You have Admiral Fallon, who's the commander-in-chief of CENTCOM. He's going to weigh in. You also have the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who basically are taking a look not just at Iraq, but all of our security interests around the world. So I think that that's going to be an offsetting dynamic. No one should be surprised that General Petraeus will say it's working because the president has put him in an impossible position by keep saying it's Petraeus' strategy rather than Petraeus carrying out the administration's strategy. So I think that you have to look at that. The General Accounting Office is going to give a report on the 1st of September. You also have another report from General Jones that the Congress has asked for. So I think with all of those things, then I think there may be some move toward withdrawal. And in my view, Senator Warner's comments were important, not just for what he said, but the fact that who it was that said it, that basically said, you know, we need to move in a different direction, and we can argue about the specifics about how to do it. And Brian, go ahead. You want to?
This is Brian Katulis. I think this Congress, the 110th Congress, has certainly exercised a great deal more oversight than the previous Congress over the Iraq War. And I think you may see in the fall the reintroduction of some measures like the measure proposed by Senators Hagel and Webb and Congresswoman Tauscher on the House side to focus on military readiness. And the need for military readiness, the need to have a deployment policy that gives our troops sufficient rest. I think you'll also have a push in various legislative vehicles like the Foreign Operations Bill to try to put some stress on the so-called diplomatic surge and the recommendations of the Iraq Study Group saying that we need to actually focus on political solutions to Iraq's conflicts, because I think there's been growing consensus and a recognition that the overwhelming majority of Iraq's violence is a vicious struggle for power. It's a struggle for power among different Iraqi factions, and more boots on the ground aren't going to resolve that, particularly when those boots are worn down and have been there for more than 4.5 years. So I think you're going to see a steady ratcheting up of pressure and oversight over the president's policies. Will it result in his changing the course? I think that's an open question, and I think it comes down to his power as the commander-in-chief to really set the terms for national security policy.
Well, if I could follow up, then would you suspect then that the funding bills beyond the end of September would contain some sort of contingency which would force that hand?
This is Larry Korb. I think, as Brian said, you're going to have probably two things. One is the Skelton-Tauscher proposal, also Lugar-Warner, which tells the president to present a withdrawal plan. You will also have an attempt to enforce the Army's policy that people have to stay home at least a year before they redeploy, and I think those will be the steps. But remember, there's going to be a lot of bills and a lot of votes. We've just learned today that the president is going to propose $50 billion more in addition to the $146 billion. That was supposed to be the supplemental for 2008. And again, that would keep the surge going through October of 2008, and I think the Congress may not allocate all of that in a way to begin to force the troop levels down.
And this is Brian Katulis. If I could add one more that's been discussed up on the Hill is applying current law, for instance, the Leahy legislation, which bars U.S. taxpayer money from going to known human rights abusers. And more we're getting increasing reports out of Iraq and Baghdad that some of the Iraqi security forces themselves, those that we're giving weapons to, may be and have been involved with sectarian cleansing campaigns. And I think you're going to see more initiatives. Will they cut off the funds completely? I think that's unlikely. But I think you're going to see a lot more oversight over what are some deeply problematic aspects of the president's Iraq strategy.
Thank you.
Again, to ask a question, press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. Our next question comes from Mark Benjamin from Salon. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I had a question about this. If you're talking about a phased military redeployment that starts now and goes over the next 10 to 12 months, and military necessity in terms of the rotation, these 15-month tours and so on and so forth, will dictate that sometime very early next spring, there's going to be a dial back, the beginning of a phased military redeployment anyways. Does it mean that this entire debate over, you know, redeploying from Iraq has come down to basically the debate about over 6 months? We either do it now or we do it when we have to early next year. Is that right?
Yeah, Marcus, Larry Korb. No, I don't think so, because I think yes, you will cut back down, but you go back down to about 130,000 troops. And the issue is, do you go back to where you were before the surge or do you keep going? I think that's what it's going to be. But there's no doubt about the fact that come next spring, you're going to have to start drawing down. But I think what the administration would like to do is go back down to the pre-surge level. And so at the end of 2008, you'll have roughly, 130,000 troops left in Iraq. And you can do that without extending the tours.
So you can keep 130 in there for a long period of time without extending the tours. You just can't keep 160.
That's correct. You can't keep 160. Again, you would have some times where you'd have to do less than 1 year for certain specific units. But I think it's interesting that Bob Gates, basically right now, Secretary of Defense Gates, says that if you want to send a unit back before a year, he has to personally approve it. And in fact, he stopped a battalion in Germany from going back that had only been home seven or eight months. So I think it'll be tough even to keep quite at the 130 without violating the 1 year at home. And his policy on Guard and Reserve is no more than one year out of every six. And after this surge is complete, will he go back to that? So, I mean, if you did that and enforced it rigorously, you're talking about getting down close to about 100,000.
And just one quick follow-up. There's a sentence in the report that talks about a quick withdrawal or redeployment. It says, such an exit would create an instantaneous political and security vacuum similar to that created by the initial overthrow of Saddam Hussein. That seems to suggest that going quickly will create this vacuum. Why would going slowly make that vacuum any less acute? I mean, you're still going to have a vacuum. You're just either going to have a vacuum slowly or you're going to have a vacuum quickly. What does it matter?
Well, I think the point we were trying to make is if you give the Iraqis notice that you're getting out in a year, that will allow you basically to have a diplomatic surge, as we've urged in some of our other reports, that you can work with the countries in the region, as well as put the Iraqis on a reasonable notice. I mean, if you started right now and took your troops out over the next 12 months, it would have been, you know, would have been there over 5 years, and that should certainly be adequate time for them to get their act together. So that's what we were saying. In 3 months, I mean, that would go very, very, very quickly, and it'd be hard to get all your diplomatic ducks in a row, and you know, give the Iraqis the time to do what they need to do. So that's why we're saying, you know, 10 to 12 months would be the least bad option. But your point is well taken. There are no good options right now, given, you know, how we went in and why we went into Iraq and the previous mistakes that we've made.
And let me just add, this is Max Bergman, that I think there's actually two debates here. One is when to actually start redeploying our forces. And that is a debate that I think, you know, our hand will be sort of forced next year to draw down our forces. The second one that we're seeing is how long it would actually take to accomplish a complete withdrawal of U.S. forces. And there, I think there's considerable disagreement. Just, you know, you look at some of the presidential candidates, some have said it'll take as long as, you know, Senator Biden has said as long as at least 2 years. Others have said you could do it in 6 months. And I think what this report seeks to show is the logistics that would go into withdrawing in over a year. That essentially the debate is over equipment and what sort of equipment do you value. And, you know, we look at if you get out the most critical equipment, your expensive tanks, vehicles, and electronic equipment and other items like that, that you would be able to get that equipment out over the course of the year, and you would sacrifice some of the non-essential equipment that isn't vital to American national security, and that you could do it safely over the course of a year. So from start to finish, you could accomplish it in 10 to 12 months.
Yeah. And this is Larry Korb, Mark. Let me add one other thing. As we point out in the report, if you don't set the specific deadline, you're hostage to events. And, you know, they've almost killed the Ayatollah Sistani a couple of times. If something like that should happen and the civil war became even more ferocious than it is now, you might have to get out in a couple of months, and that would prevent you from taking out all of the equipment that you might like.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take a question from Robert Dreyfus from The Nation. Go ahead, please.
There's been a lot of talk from various quarters, Stephen Biddle and others, that is kind of an all or nothing strategy. How much is the troop level contingent on accomplishing some basic mission? In other words, if you start pulling out below 130,000, 120, 110, is there some tipping point at which we're just unable to guarantee this? Either the security of Iraq or our own forces.
Yeah, Bob. This is Larry Korb. And if Steve Biddle's argument, I think, is correct for those people that say, "Okay, take out all of your troops and then leave this small residual force," we think basically if you announce that you're getting out over 12 months and then you begin to do it, you're probably going to minimize the damage to U.S. forces. And I think Steve's point is if you leave only 50,000, they're not going to be able to defend themselves the way that you'd like. And the Army just did a war game, which we quote in here, and they made the basic point. If they know we're leaving, they're probably not going to want to fight us on the way out, because that's the last thing most of the people fighting there want, is for us to remain.
And how much – could you say a little bit more about the difference between – the commanders on the ground in Iraq and the military officers back here? You alluded to differences, but we saw some reports about Peter Pace suggesting a fairly significant below 100,000 levels by the end of next year. Can you say to what extent there's this debate going on within the military?
Yeah, this is Larry Korb again, Bob. Yeah, you always have that from the people in charge of looking at overall U.S. security interests as opposed to people in the theater. If you go back to the Korean War, MacArthur got very upset at General Bradley, who wouldn't send him even more troops to Korea. He said, well, you know, this is where they have chosen to fight us. And Bradley said it's the wrong war, wrong time, wrong place. Where, you know, Europe is our strategic interest. We'll give you enough to, you know, what we think is to prevent yourself from getting thrown out of Korea, but we're not going to give you all of the forces that we need. The same way Westmoreland, General Westmoreland, after the Tet Offensive, asked for 200,000 more troops. And his colleagues back in Washington basically said, wait a second here, you know, Vietnam, we have other interests around the world. You may remember when the Pueblo was sieged in the spring of 1968, we couldn't do anything because all of the forces that should have been there to protect the Pueblo were down in the Gulf of Tonkin. So this is normal that you have this. Now, what makes this debate different is that the president keeps invoking Petraeus as the one who has the strategy, whereas his predecessors have never put so much on the field commander and basically said, you know, this is MacArthur's strategy, this is Westmoreland's strategy. So I think that that's what you're going to see. I mean, Admiral Mullen in his confirmation hearings has already indicated that he's concerned, as we are here in this report and some of the other ones, about what's happening to the Army. And General Pace has talked about the concerns about what would happen if something happened in Korea. Admiral Fallon, don't forget, has responsibility for Afghanistan as well as Iraq, and you can use more troops there. So I think that's the disagreement that you're going to see this time. Remember that Casey and Abizaid both opposed the surge. Casey was the field commander. Abizaid was the central commander because they said that would increase the Iraqis' dependence on us. General Casey now is in charge with the overall well-being of the Army and is a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff with American interests around the globe.
And let me just add, I think, to the first point, this is Max Bergman, that part of what we would be doing is consolidating our presence first. So we would be taking units that were out in the further reaches of the country in Anbar province and moving them in further into the center to Baghdad. And the purpose of that is so that no units would be caught sort of isolated. So I think we would minimize some of the risk that could be created if you were to sort of draw down across the board, that we consolidate our presence and then eventually we would move out fairly quickly through the airfields or through the route down to Kuwait.
We have no further questions at this time.
I just wanted to thank everybody for calling in. Once again, the report, if you haven't had a chance to look at it, is available at our website, americanprogress.org. And also, and this may be important as well, we plan to post the audio of this call on the report page on americanprogress.org, so in case you want to get back and get some quotes. Also, as I mentioned before, if you're interested in talking to any of the authors of the report, if you have any further questions, you can call me. My name again is John Neuroer, and you can call me at 202-481-8182, or you can email me at jneuroher@americanprogress.org. So I thank our speakers once again, and thank you for calling in.